Today on the Profitable Tradie podcast.
This is going to be the thing that's going to retire you or not, or provide a good financial future or not. You can pursue a lot of this by being a tradesman. But if you're like, hey, I'm trying to scale up a business and I want to be the biggest and baddest and I've got these big dreams, but I'm not building a system or I don't know how to build a system or I refuse to because I'm too busy or whatever it is, just know that you're setting yourself up for a bit of a joke.
If you've ever wondered what separates the contracting and tradie businesses that grow successfully from the ones that just stay stuck with a couple of vans and a heap of stress, then this episode is for you. Now, that turns out there's a bunch of common traits among successful business and business owners.
Chances are you're going to waste a lot of money a lot of times. And like, marketing will change. Every year, what works will change. And so as you, if you monitor it, you have benchmarks, you can change with it and adapt to it. But if you don't see the math behind it, you're going to get real work.
And on this episode, I talked to Danny Kerr, an expert in what makes businesses successful. Now, Danny is the host of the Contractor Evolution podcast from Breakthrough Academy and has worked with thousands of contractors and tradies. Now, between us, we've seen what works and what doesn't. And I thought it'd be fun to talk through what you need to do to crack it as an owner of a contracting or a tradie business.
As a business, 90% of the time, it usually does work out, and 10% of the time, it does not. And I find that the people that might criticize you when that 10% is going wrong and make you feel like absolute garbage, it's because they're less risk takers. They didn't take the risk that you had to take to get here.
On today's episode, I'm excited to interview Danny Kerr, the host of the Contractor Evolution podcast. Now, Danny is an industry leader on what it takes to make your business successful. So welcome, Danny. I'm super excited to hang out today, buddy.
Tony, I love talking to you. I feel we have so much in common. This is going to be a great not only show, but I'm just glad to hang out with you again.
It is. It's like you're like a brother from another mother. So obviously, you know, the work you do at Breakthrough Academy, you work with thousands of business owners in the contracting and tradie space, and we do something similar. So I think there's a real good symmetry here about some of the stuff. So just to start off with, to talk about what a successful business actually means in the contracting space, because I think that's a good place to start when we're talking about successful businesses.
Yeah, I mean, you have to break down what is a business, right? I mean, I've fallen in love with my business. I call it my fourth child. And I think a lot of contractors and owners do, right? It's the journey that's taken so much from us, but also given us so much meaning in life. But you have to be careful not to make it all you, right? And as you get older and as you start to have kids and you start to build more of a life around yourself, you start to realize if all I am is a successful businessman, is that really success? And so I think big picture, I think a business should make you the money that you need, right? And make sure that it's stable and that you can support your family with it. You can support your employees. You can provide value to the marketplace and do it in a nice, stable way, because being financially stressed is not fun and not paying yourself properly is not fun. And it takes away from the essence of the organization. But I also think that a successful businessman has the time that they deserve. And I think that we sometimes don't know what to do with all that time. So we go and work more, but like, to actually find other things that fulfill you in life is important. I think a lot of us listening right now are OCD, obsessed about business type people. And we get a lot of, I call it dopamine hits from it. But if it's the only thing that gives us dopamine, because we spent so much time doing only that one thing, when we do retire one day, or we do slow down, or we do pull out of the day-to-day too much, we'll get depressed because we won't have meaning. And I think it's important as a business owner to find time to do other things for a lot of reasons. But I think one of them is that you need to one day realize that your business wasn't the only thing that made you happy. And for some people, that might sound like an insane thing to say, because you're busy every day and you're running around 80 hours a week and you're like, man, I would want nothing but time. But trust me, I've seen this with a lot of people. They retire, they sell their business, they step back too much, and they get depressed because they don't know how to spend time with themselves or with their families or doing other interests. And so I think a successful business person has the money that they want and the business is stable and they have the time that they deserve and they know what to do with it.
I love it. I've heard it described as a successful business as a commercial profitable enterprise that works without you. And I really like that, because it's quite tight and it means that the business will make money without you necessarily having to do it, so that you can do all those things that I think you mentioned. And to be successful in business means you do have time to invest in some other interests as well, because I 100% agree, if you're just business, it does make you a pretty dull boy, but you don't realize it until you have a bit of time, and then the wheels can come off life a little bit as well.
There was a time I realized the stress of being underwhelmed was much worse than the stress of being overwhelmed, if that makes kind of sense. And so I spent so much time working 8 hours a week, and it was like, man, I need to get out of some of this. I was running a franchise at the time, so I decided not to sign back up from my franchisor. I was going to go take a year flying helicopters. Sounds cool. Everyone's like, oh, that's an amazing thing to go do. I was more stressed out doing so little in my life, because I had like one class a week and that was it, that I realized I have to go back into business. I actually am not prepared to like not have that thing, that business thing in my life. So it's good. It's like motivated me through my younger years, but it's also something I never forgot. And I realized like, hey, Danny, just so you know, like 38 right now, like when you're 48, like, is it going to still feel that way? Or are you going to have other things to fill your time with that are meaningful.
And meaning is important. And I think that the key thing is a successful business isn't just one that makes money, because you can have all the money in the world, but if you have no time and you haven't invested in other stuff to fill your life up, then it's not going to be much fun. So I think we've got similar thoughts on that. What I'd love to do then is talk about what is the, in your opinion, the single most important thing that successful owners do that others don't?
Well, I wrote three.
Because you're an overachiever, I get it.
The single most important thing. I think that, I mean, there's different stages in this, right? So I think that the first thing, if you're starting a business and you're like, what does it take to be successful as a business owner versus an employee? The number one thing I've identified, actually, this goes back to when I used to bring in franchises. So I used to recruit and hire and develop franchisees for a painting company. The ability to handle stress in pursuit of a goal was the number one trait that would dictate success in a startup franchise. So that franchisee's ability to handle all the newness, all the transition of going from employee to owner and taking on the responsibility when you suddenly realize there's no one else to take it on and still be able to forge forward with a relatively like calm mind was the thing that made success out of so many franchisees. And they were just like, there was those who quit because it got too hard. There was those who gave up mentally, but maybe kept going, but like mentally they were out. You know, that fight or flight scenario in your brain, if you can manage through that to find, you know, calm, I think that determines early on for a business, it's like ability to be successful or not, that owner's ability to stay mentally clear.
I mean, it's a huge thing, isn't it? Because when your brain is in that fight, urgent response thing, we've looked at this a lot, and the research shows that you actually become a dumber version of yourself because your ability to access the kind of forward thinking, proactive planning, strategy, emotional response type things it's really diminished. And so you tend to act out of just reaction and make short-term decisions that often aren't the things that you need to do. And you just get overwhelmed, your energy gets destroyed, and life's a tough place. So definitely the trait of being calm, and it applies to everything in life, doesn't it? Like your good sports people are all the ones, not necessarily the most talented, but the ones who are the calmest under pressure, and they can actually execute in the tough situation. So I definitely think that's a huge thing.
It's like the highest performing athletes on the planet can only get so good physically, and the rest is mental. I think entrepreneurs are in that category. We have to perform at an extremely high mental level, and it's not just about being smart. Actually, a lot of it is about managing emotions so that you can make clear decisions along the way.
Yeah, there's one thing that really jumps out at me as well, which is probably at a more, I guess, practical, tactical level. And I see this a lot, is that the business owners who focus on sound financial management, for me, that's a massive indicator of success. And what I mean by that is they actually measure how their business is performing. And so they'll measure how profitable their jobs are. That's probably the most important thing. And then they'll roll that up into a monthly P&L, for example. And so they can actually understand, am I making money? And then they also know how well they are doing, which allows them to actually iterate, which is like, okay, that's where I'm at. I can make some improvements and track how they impact the business. And so for me, it's very hard to judge success and to make improvements if you don't know what you're tracking. And so if they track stuff, it makes a massive difference for what we've seen work.
You can see what levers to pull and how far to pull them, yeah, what direction to, yeah, take them. And you understand the nuances, because especially in the beginning, I do think we can run a business off our gut fairly well. It's us and two or three people. It's like, you know what, I feel this, I hear this, I talked to my customer yesterday about this, and you're touching everything. I didn't make money on that job, I can see it, right? But as soon as you start to pull up 5, 10, 15 people, you're not going to be aware as much as you think you are about what's really going on in your organization. And numbers don't lie. And I've always said to people, look, like, you can make decisions from your heart all day long, but you need to have the head piece as well. And it's the combination of those two things that makes a good, well-rounded decision. And you are, yeah, likely in your business, the success and failure of it are merely a product of the decisions you're making over the actions you take, especially as you put people in between you and the day-to-day operations. Your ability to make good decisions that actually are the right ones without there is a clear answer. Like, our job as entrepreneurs is like, there's not clarity here, but you need to make a call. You need more than your gut. You need data.
Yeah, data is massive. And I can think of so many examples of members that we've worked with who, starting out, don't have cash. You know, they have cash flow challenges. They're under the pump. And you get them to, and I guess the magic trick we find is if they start actually costing some of the jobs they're doing, they'll find that there's certain clients or certain niches or segments of the work that they do that are just actually not making any money and are potentially taking money away from the business. And when they realize that, they're like, flipping heck, this is a light bulb moment. You know, they do one of two things. things. They either put the prices up on those, which is a great idea, or two, they stop doing them. Well, they do both. They put the prices up and the clients stop using them, which is a win often as well. And automatically things start to improve. So I think that data piece is massive. And as you said, as you get bigger, you have bigger decisions to make. And I mean, a classic one, and I'd love to dig into this a bit later, is if you're thinking of hiring someone, it's like, wow, how much money is that going to cost? I need an estimator. I'm going to spend $100,000, for example, might be more. How am I going to know that that's going to pay off? Well, you track the numbers, you see how it performs, because you're not hiring them forever. You know, you can actually get rid of them if it doesn't work. So I think that for me is massive. But as you said, if you can manage your stress and stay focused, then you'll make time to do that stuff. So I think those two things actually fit, you know, really nicely together.
There's a really good, you probably know this calculation, but the break-even point for costs, right? So if you have a $100,000 manager you want to hire, and let's just say you make 50% margins on your projects, maybe make 30, 20, whatever, but you take that 50% and you divide it into the $100,000 that you need to cost, that person's going to cost you. And you realize I need $200,000 in revenue to pay for that $100,000 cost. And it's a really quick math equation. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, is that person going to allow us as a company to bring in $200,000 more worth of revenue? And the hope is that they do more than that, because if they're only breaking even on their cost, that's actually not a good thing. But you can sit there and you can actually just calculate the math of it. But if you don't even know how much margin you're making on projects, or you don't even know how that influences on your overhead, yeah, it's easy to go. And I see people do this all the time. They grow revenue and they don't understand what overhead cost should be in the business at what time. They sometimes overspend or underspend. They overspend, their margins are deteriorated. If they underspend, they're all maxed and stressed. And it's about balancing that equation as you grow.
Yeah, this is a huge thing too. You think about a big challenge is people are busy, but they can't service the demand of the marketplace, and they're struggling to find technicians. But they're like, wow, I'm paying my technicians, I don't know, let's grab $100,000 a year. And they're like, well, I got a guy who wants $120,000. There's no way I can pay him that. That's ridiculous. We're not paying him that. But they haven't understood the math, and the math might be that that extra technician is going to generate $500,000 worth of revenue, or $600,000, or whatever it is. And at a 50% margin, it might be adding $200,000 or $300,000 in gross profit, which is like a no-brainer. Pay $120,000, get $300,000, that's a win. But often, without understanding the numbers, people just can't do that because it's just not clear. So I think, yeah, as you said, that's massive. Drilling down on those details so you can make those decisions.
Got it.
Okay, let's talk about a common trap, which is getting stuck on the tools out in the field. You know, doing the jobs. So what I'd love to kick around, Danny, is how do you see the successful operators moving out of this phase while still maintaining control of the work?
I mean, I remember doing this. So I was 19. I'd done 1 year running my own business, and I had run all the projects myself, and I was bringing in a project manager to run my crews for the very first time. The first thing I had to understand was, what is this job? Because often the job that we are doing right now is the least documented part of our entire company, right? Because we're the ones doing it. So we can plug all the holes, and we can do it all ourselves, and we can make it all our own thing. And I've actually seen this to this day, even running the business I run today. Like, the last role I just stepped out of, unfortunately, is the least systemized role in the company, because I was able to cheat and just do it all in my own little daily way. So being aware of this and being conscious that, hey, like, maybe I have a really good process around how technicians, I used to be in painting, so like how they paint homes. But do I have a really good process around how I manage production? Because I was just managing production for the last year or two. So I would say the first thing is, like, understand what it takes to do your job and what is the process, because you probably, especially as an entrepreneur, don't have it well structured. It's probably your own harebrained way of doing things. Take a bit of time doing that, and take a bit of time identifying what is it that makes you do well at this job, right? So a production manager, it's probably leadership, probably the ability to handle and manage people and conflict, probably the ability to be organized, right? And there's, like, traits that make this job do well. Now take all of that, and the biggest thing you can do is start recruiting more intentionally. So I'm not just looking for somebody who's been a project manager in the past, but I'm more looking for somebody who has the traits to be a good project manager. What are the personality traits that allow them to do well in this role? So one thing we teach, and I think you teach this as well, but to not just, like, recruit based on, like, your needs as an owner, but recruit based on the needs of the type of person you're trying to attract. So your ideal candidate profile is developed, and you're looking at the role required, the skills required, the personality traits, and then you're starting to say, how do I build a campaign to attract those types of people? And then from there, we talked a bit about it earlier, it's like, then build them into a training process. And I would love to say that I did a perfect job of this. I did not. Actually, I'm telling you this from my learning when I was 19 years old doing this improperly and stumbling over myself a bit, realizing, like, I had to build things as on the way down as I was bringing him into his job.
Yeah, it's definitely a pinch point, isn't it? When you want to get off the tools, out of the field, because you know that to grow the business, you need to do that. But that fear of it crumbling, feeling, or sometimes it's a fear of you don't know what you need to do in the next role yourself. You know, like I'm going to turn into a manager and a leader, and I'm not very familiar with that, but I am very familiar with actually punching jobs out and staying on top of the team out in the field to get jobs done. So there's quite a lot of mental high jumps to get through for people. And also there's that often that fear of control, like, are they going to do a decent job? What happens if they mess it up for the clients? And so that really plays on people's minds. So I think, as you mentioned, kind of systemizing or getting out of your head what you do is absolutely critical. Hiring great people is massive. And again, this is a mindset shift, because it's like, I'll be honest, when we talk to people often, they're like, oh, there's no way I could pay that much for someone. But actually, to get good people generally costs you a little bit more than you want. And it should be a bit uncomfortable, because a good person is, honestly, it's worth three average people. And it's worth spending that little bit extra to get a good person. And the other thing that I've found from a headspace point of view is that there's an inverse relationship between control and growth. So if you want to grow, you know.
Yeah, you become the bottleneck of your own.
Exactly. I'm sure you've seen this in the people you're talking with.
Yeah, and I was going to say too, like, just expect the fact that, like, you're going to hire someone, even if you hire an A player, you're going to hire someone who's not going to do it as well as you are. And it's okay. Chances are over time, they'll become much better than you. But their first 3 or 4 months, or even a year sometimes, they're not gonna. And you need to be patient with that. I remember, like, I always had a goal where I was like, look, we have to hit our goals this year as a company, but, like, I can't go do it for you. The only way that I'm allowed to do this is through you. So I have to tie my hands behind my back, and I have to be able to communicate with you and coach you, train you, develop you, motivate you, hold accountability to you, but I can't do it for you. And I made a rule for myself to, like, and so I'm pretty motivated to hit my company goals. I have to, but I'm not allowed to do it. I have to train it. I have to teach it. I have to coach it. I have to motivate it through someone. So who do I choose that person to be? My whole responsibility is to help you hit your goals, not to go hit them for you. And it's just like a rule you have to make.
Yeah. And it sounds easy. It's actually
very hard.
Super challenging. And it's probably why so many people find this as a stumbling point. And often we find is that, some of the people we talk with have sort of gone to the point where they've got out of doing all the projects, but then they find themselves dragged back into it, and they have this yo-yo effect of I'm out, I'm in. And you may have experienced that if you're listening, but this is where this attitude that you're talking about, Danny, really comes in. It's like, eventually you have to make the call that I'm going to get the work done through other people. My role is to train, grow, and develop the team and let them do it. And I think you touched on something. They may not be as good as you. Often they're not. But you weren't that good when you got started either. And the way you got good is by practicing and stubbing your toe and making mistakes and learning. And so you have to be prepared for the people in your business to do some of that as well, because that's how they get good.
I was going to give you a model too. Like, maybe you, Tony, you know what it's called. You've heard of the situational leadership model? You can Google it.
Yes. Right? Really, yeah, well, it's massive. Yeah.
It's fairly well known. It's just, it'd be good to bring attention to that for everybody, just to realize, go Google this for yourself. It's basically just like, what type of communication style should I have with this person and their skill set based on where they're at? So if they don't know anything, they don't really know how to do the task or the responsibility very well, I have to be high direction. It's exactly how you do it. It's exactly what matters, so on and so forth. If they kind of know, they've done this with you for a while, they kind of know the task, but they don't really understand the bigger picture, like, they can't problem solve themselves, it's usually time for the next style of coaching, where you're letting them know why things are done the way they're done. And you're always showing them what to do, but then letting them know why it's done that way. And then finally, over time, they're going to start to know why and how to do the task, but their confidence in doing it without checking with you first is fairly low, because they're used to having you as their safety blanket. And so then you move into this next style of leadership, where you're not there to answer any questions, you're there to be their sounding board. So they're going to come to you with tons of questions, and you're going to say, great, what do you think you should do in that scenario? What do you think is best? And let them answer their own questions and let them realize, oh, actually, I do have the answer. So you're leveling up their confidence now. And then finally, once confidence is high enough and skill is high enough, that's when you can get to the delegative phase of, I'm going to delegate this down to you. And where I find a lot of people screw this up is they go high direction at the beginning, and then they go straight to delegation. The person screws up and they go, let me take it back. You can't do this. It's like, no, you actually have to, like, take time to develop them through, like, high direction, some coaching, where it's like letting them know the why, and then being their sounding board. It's called supportive style leadership, where you're there as a sounding board, and finally then into delegation over time.
Yeah, it's gold. The way you approach the person depends on where they're at. And that means that you as a leader have to become quite aware and have multiple tools in your toolbox, as you would for any project. Choose the right tool to deal with the person and the situation in front of you in terms of your followers. So that's a magic formula, because you're right. Most people come with a certain style as a leader. Mm-hmm. So they may be quite, you know, quite directive and autocratic, or they may be completely hands off. And often their success is just luck because the person in front of them happened to suit their style rather than actually choosing it. So yeah, that's a definite Google, that one, the situational leadership. And it's taught at all universities as well. So it's kind of the basis of effective leadership. So Danny, we're talking a lot about people here. And I think that's a theme that's coming through in, you know, what it takes to be successful. So how do the successful business owners actually approach hiring compared to those who struggle with this?
I think you need to see it as a sales process, almost like you see, like if you see a sales process, you see like, who's our ideal customer? How do we generate leads to get that customer? What is the like discovery process to go through making sure that is the right customer? What's the estimate process? How do we sell and how do we close? Well, the same steps are true for recruitment. Who is our ideal candidate? How do we target that ideal candidate through the right kind of verbiage and ads and the language that we use? How do we then pre-screen for that candidate before we spend too much time with them in an interview, so I don't waste my time with no-shows and a bunch of people that aren't a good fit? Then when I'm doing that interview, what are the traits I need to actually look for and the personality traits I need to look for in that person? Do I have them predetermined by role? Most people don't. And then finally, from there, how do I make a final selection? Because here's what also happens is when the final selection actually comes, you'll usually pick from the top, whatever, three people you met with that last 2 weeks, but maybe none of them are a fit. And the only way to objectively view, is this actually a good fit for the role, is to go back to the original like ideal profile of who you were looking for and read through that and be like, does this person match what I wrote originally? Or am I just making up crap because I need to fill a role next week?
Looking for what I want to see.
Yeah, rose-colored glasses, whatever we call it. So yeah, it's having a process around it. And I will say within that process, realizing like, hey, like if you understand sales, you understand that like you need a certain amount of leads to do a certain amount of estimates, to have a certain amount of jobs, to have a certain amount of revenue. Well, the recruiting game is the exact same. Like we just hired a full-time recruiter actually for our organization, and he runs exactly like our sales org runs. And he's proud of his funnel. And he's always talking about how many applicants he's generated and how many first meetings he's had and how many second meetings he's had. And he's tracking his conversion ratios throughout each. And he's tweaking it based on those ratios. And I think when we can start to see it more as that type of game, we can start to actually improve it, because you can't change again what you don't see. And if you just feel like you're on a gauntlet of getting some applications, interviewing a few of them and seeing what happens, you're not seeing where there's room for improvement.
I think the theme there that you're, you know, really alluding to is that you have to be professional about hiring. You have to take it super seriously. And this is really tough when you've bootstrapped yourself up by, you know, getting a van or a truck and starting business. And then maybe you've got someone else to help and you've got two or three people, four people. So you haven't done a lot of hiring, you know, it's sort of happened. But to really go to that next level, hiring and team is the absolute key to success. And it's understanding that it becomes basically your main job is to hire good people. And that is quite a mindset shift. And it means that you want to be good at it, which means you've got to have good systems. You've got to practice, and iron sharpens iron. The more you do it, the better you get at it, which is frustrating because you want good people at the start, but it is a process. And I think something for me, Danny, that really stands out is that the marketing for talent becomes more important than the marketing for clients. That's the whole process you alluded to. That becomes the most important thing, because if you market for the right talent, well, they'll take care of the marketing for clients anywho. And for me, and I know we've talked about this a little bit before, is you basically want to create a brand in the marketplace where people, the tradespeople and the people that you need, see you as an employer of choice. And what we've found with a lot of our members is they do a big, you know, work on their organic socials. And the biggest impact for them is that they hire better people. They're like, oh, wow, this has actually helped for hiring more than it helped for actually getting clients, because you've built this brand in the marketplace. And the good people are like, this looks like a great place to work. And I can see other people like me working there. And I can see the cool projects you're working on. And I can see that you do some stuff for your team and that it's a great place and culture is important. And so it's like a full court pressure in terms of building that brand in the marketplace.
Yeah, there's the, you know, you might build a website or a brand or, you know, whatever. You might have some marketing agency come in and help you. Make sure you don't just talk about your ideal customer. Talk about your ideal candidates or your ideal employees and say, I want to build a brand that speaks to both in a really healthy way and brings all of us together under one common set of core values. I will say also more tactical too, like building that then needs to lead down to like, how do I get the message out? One thing I wrote down was like, we are likely in the recession of people and have been for the last 10 years. There's less people available to do the work than there is work to be done, which means we're fighting in a marketplace, not only against other contractors, but other jobs generally out in the marketplace for good people anyways. B and C level people, there's always someone to do the work. But if you want A level candidates, like you need to be pretty aware that there's less of them than there is to do good work. So one thing I've always been a big proponent of is the difference between passive and active marketing tactics. Well, like same thing as passive and active recruiting tactics. Passive is like putting up posts on job boards and waiting for people to apply to you. Active is actually reaching out to your ideal candidate and getting getting their attention. So, you know, you can do this through networking with your team. We're actually, you know, once a year, we would have a big networking exercise, say a team of 10 or 20 gets together. I used to do with my painters, and I would drop my ideal candidate profile. I would drop by my job ads, and I would usually have them posted on our website. And I would have them each message 100 to 200 people each, basically saying, hey, so-and-so, our company XYZ is looking for a person in XYZ role. Curious if you know anybody who would be a good fit. Please see the link below. You know, PS, we're offering a $1,000 hiring bonus. Happy to share that with you if you didn't know anyone. And so they're not saying, do you want a job? That's why they can message 100 people, but it's to their people that they have a good network with, people that are well connected, and people that actually might be a good fit for the job, but they're never asking them, do you want a job? They're just saying, do you know anyone? They're letting that person then click on that ad. Hey, it's $1,000. Maybe I'll check it out, see if there's anyone I know that fit it. Some of them are reading it being like, that's totally me. Some of them are like, that's totally my cousin. And some of them, no, not at all. But if you have, say, 10 staff on your team right now, and they each send 100 messages each out together, you do this, I usually like pizza and beer night, and we do it all together. That's 1,000 direct messages that goes out to your staff's network in like a couple hours. That's a very direct outreach, active process versus just, hey, do you know anyone? Let us know. Like, they'll send it up to their one cousin that maybe is jobless right now.
That's killer. And I think sitting underneath that is that you actually have to put a lot of effort into this. We find the people we've helped, they've just sort of put an ad up and hoped for the best. That doesn't work. I can tell you now, you just can't hope for the best. You've actually got to work it really, really hard to get the people. And it is worth the effort. And I know it's tough when you've got projects and clients and cash flow and receivables and stuff, but this stuff is what makes all those other things easier if you get the right people. So that's a great little tactic, Danny. I reckon someone should steal that and
take it. I talk about it all the time. There's a lot of them, right? But that was one that I used to do annually. And it was just a good networking exercise that I was like, every year we need to do this with our team. This is how you network through your team. And I think you can do it. Just ask your team, let them know there's $1,000 hiring bonus even, but that's passive. Doing it with them for 2 hours and having them message out that many people is a very active.
I love it. So the thing is, when hiring, there's often a stress for the business owner is, you know, should they hire first or should they get the work first? And we come up against this a lot, like, oh, I'm scared I won't have the work or whatever. So what's your take on that one?
So I wrote hiring first.
Nice. Good. Okay, we're done. I agree.
I wrote it because I think that to get the work first is a bit of a disaster. You're already setting yourself up for failure because you're going to go get the work and then suddenly realize you don't have the people for the work. So you're going to scramble to get the people for the work, which are likely not going to be the right people or the best people, which means now you've hired people that you're going to have to fire later anyways. I've been through this cycle. So you're kind of like, my goal is to grow, but I won't grow unless I get the work. I'm like, then you're setting yourself up for a really hairy growth process. The growth is going to be shitty, if we're honest. If you want to have a successful growth process, you also need to trust in yourself as an entrepreneur and be able to say, hey, I'm going to get the best people I possibly can, and then I'm going to fight like hell, bring them the work they need. And it motivates you. And I've seen this with franchisees. I've tested this out. When I used to run franchises, it was like, you know, some guys want to play it safe. They don't get the work. They get busy with other stuff. The people that hired and they've got 4 staff to provide work for and they got 2 months to bring in the work, they are motivated like nobody's business. And yeah, did they work more hours than they wanted to and grind it out more, probably more than they should have at certain days? Yeah, they did, but they got the work for them. And it's that fire under their ass that made a difference.
Yeah, it's that creating the vacuum. That's the term I was looking for, yeah. And so when you have to, you will. But if you don't have to, you won't. It's a capacity problem. You know, most people don't realize when they don't hire that they're letting go of opportunities. So their team is tapped out. So they are a little bit slow answering some inquiries, which means they miss out on jobs. They're a little bit slow getting some bids and quotes out. So they miss out on jobs. They're a little bit slow following up the bids and quotes they've put out. So they miss out on some more jobs. So they don't realize that actually they already have another half or three quarters of a person's worth of work if they were actually able to do it right now. I see that all the time. Not to mention all the referral business they're missing out on because they're missing out on new clients who might refer more people or get repeat work. So that's a big thing. And for me, I've got this little rule. I call it the 80% rule. You should be hiring when you're at 80% capacity because any more than that, if you're up towards 100%, your ability to actually do the hiring properly, to actually induct and train and get people set up, you're just maxed out and you do a rubbish job of it and you get stuck in that urgent cycle, that sort of fight or flight thing you mentioned at the start. So I think the 80% rule is a great rule when it comes to making the decisions around whether to hire or get the work first.
I like that. I've not heard that before. But you're right. It's kind of like, okay, I'll hire more when I need more. It's like, well, usually by the time I realize I need more, it's already too late.
It's too late. You're tapped out. You're like the frog who gets, you know, cooked in the water. You don't even realize it. And it's so hard to make good decisions when you're under the pump, because I think, as you mentioned, you tend then to just hire for a warm body, which, you know, I think we've all been guilty of doing. I, I know I have, especially early on. But it takes a lot of discipline to actually hire the right person and stick to your guns as well. And there's a lot of fear, isn't there? I mean, you know, be successful in business, you've got to learn to deal with the fear. And I think that's the emotional piece that you talked about earlier. We all feel fear. I mean, we've been in business, both of us, a long time. You still have that apprehension about when you need to make a decision. That's just the nature of it. But you actually, you know, you're comfortable with the fear a bit more. And it's not that you don't feel it, you just recognize it for what it is.
I find that as I've gotten older, I've gotten desensitized. Okay, let's say this.
Yeah, I'm desensitized too, bro. I hear you.
Well, it's two things. So like when I was 18 years old, it used to stress me out when I lost a painter. Yep. Now it's like we can lose, you know, a much more important role in our organization and it doesn't stress me out as much. The risks get larger, the things get bigger. But what I will say is when things do hit, I probably have more anxiety than I used to have when I was younger because I'm more aware of what's going on around me. So it's this weird double-edged sword. I'm able to take on way more risk because I play at a much bigger game these days. And most business owners do. Like as you level up, you deal with bigger dollars and bigger overhead and bigger, all the things. And you kind of compartmentalize that in your brain and you're desensitized, I think, a little bit to like what's going on around you, but that's fine. That's welcome to growing up. But I think you also become very aware of your family, of your kids, of the employee salaries, of the brand you've built and the name. And I've wrestled with anxiety for the first time in my life, the last couple of years as I'm growing into 40. And I think it has something to do with my age, I'm pretty sure. And it's just like this one mantra that I've had to kind of go through it all is just like, hey, it's okay. Like I'm safe. Business is a big game. We play it for fun. And if we tell ourselves otherwise, we're going to lose our heads here. But it's really like you'll create your own reality. So if you're sitting there worried about all the things that are going to go wrong, guess what's going to go wrong? All the things. If you're sitting there thinking about all the opportunities that lie in front of you, guess what's going to happen? You're going to have all these opportunities in front of you because people read energy. And learning how to manage that emotional state as you go through larger businesses, as you whatever, as life moves on, I think is massively important. And I am also still to this day working through that because no one's invincible. And I think the best entrepreneurs push themselves to that limit every single day. And so it's not just about being masterfully calm at all times. It's realizing I'm going to put myself into some shit that's like, doesn't really make me calm, but I need to find solace in that. And I need to find comfort in that. I have faith in my life. That's probably one of the biggest things that brings calm.
Faith is very, very important too for me because it puts things in a context. And I think that's the key is that most of the decisions we're facing in business are not life or death. In fact, we're pretty privileged because typically we're still going to eat in the evening and have somewhere to go to sleep, which puts us ahead of 90% of the people anywho, you know, if you think on a global scale. And so when you can frame it that way, that really gives you a lot of freedom to actually make some decisions because you want to live your best life. You don't want to get to the end and think, well, geez, I could have done this, that, and the other thing, but I didn't because I was too scared. That's not a place you want to land.
You know what I find, Tony? As a business, 90% of the time it usually does work out and 10% of the time it does not. And I find that when people who aren't running the business, maybe they work for you, maybe they're your friends even, maybe they're customers, whatever they are, the people that might criticize you when that 10% is going wrong and make you feel like absolute garbage, it's because they're less risk takers. They didn't take the risk that you had to take to get here. And if anything, I've learned to celebrate that 10% mistake because I'm like, look, it's the 10% screw ups that allowed the other 90 to go well. And it was my ability to trust in the fact that it's this model, the thing I have is like, it's going to be fine. And people are like, how can you say that? You don't know that. I'm like, I know that 90% of the time it's going to be fine. Like, what about the other 10? I'm like, totally. It's totally worth the explosion so that the other 90 could happen.
And what you'll find is that the success you're looking for does come on the other side of emotional challenge and mental challenge, because if it wasn't emotional or mental challenge, you're not doing anything new or different or interesting, which you need to do to get a different result. It's kind of by definition that these decisions around hiring and all the other decisions you make in your business do come with that sort of emotional challenge, because otherwise you'd already have done it and it wouldn't be a challenge.
And it goes back to the original point we had around like what makes a successful entrepreneur, I think, is also it's calculated risk. So like, I know this is a 90% chance of working out, a 10% chance of failure. I'm probably not going to bet the farm on something that's like 60% chance of failure, 40% chance of success, right? Like I'm going to steer away from those decisions. But if you don't know how to read your data, if you don't know how to do your financials, if you don't know how to look at not just your emotional, like how you feel about something, you don't know how to look at the numbers along the way, you can get caught in a bit of a trap where you're just like, it's going to be amazing. It's like, what's the plan? It's like, I'm not really sure. It's like, be aware of the metrics and make educated risk versus blind risk decisions. And chances are you'll have a pretty good hit rate, and celebrate the ones that aren't, learn from them, but it'll be fine.
So talking about progress, Danny, I find lots of owners get stuck in that sort of $1 to $2 million revenue. So they are successful. They've sort of lifted themselves out of that, you know, one or two or three people in their business, but they get stuck there. What has to change for those people to push through to real business success up to $5-6 million to really have a solid business that can work without them?
So I call this dip points in business, where you're actually going to spend more money and probably make a little less money actually as well and take on more risk for no apparently good reason. And the only good reason comes after when you pass that dip. right? And so what's going on is you need to sit down and be like, okay, I need probably an administrative office person. I probably need a sales manager and I probably need a production manager. But they can't all come in tomorrow because I can't afford them all. But I do need at least one of them, maybe even two of them. And I need to be adding all three as we can afford the growth of this. And it's about the strategic execution of the hiring, training, and developing of those people while financially affording those roles over the next year or two to get through that dip. And what will happen between 1 and 2 million, year one might not make a ton of sense. Like, I made less money and worked harder and this person barely did their job. I did half of it for them. Why am I doing this? And you're going to feel like I should just pull out. Screw it. Let's go back to the way things used to be. Hold on. You're halfway through your dip point. You're actually at the bottom part of your dip point. You need to spend the next year getting a little bit more revenue into the company and justifying that role and getting them trained to the point where they are competent and they can truly take on more responsibility and using that revenue, guess what? Not to make more money yet, to hire the next role between sales, production, and financials. And it's, you said between 1 and 2, I think it's kind of like between 1 and 3, 1 and 3.5. And it's like between 1 and 3.5, you'll start to get all three roles in and you'll start to see each person operate the sales team, operate the production team, and maybe take care of the office admin. And you will finally actually feel like you have a team that can execute the day-to-day operations while you can step away and lead them. Your job is to lead them and develop the future of the company. But it's that pivotal time that so many people are unsure and they pull the chute too quick. Or if they do it, they grind through it with like relative, like whatever, inaccuracies. It's pivotal because you need to put in those roles. Pivotal because those roles are going to cost you money and it's a bit of risk you need to, educated risk, like I said earlier, to take on. But to know that that is the path that every other entrepreneur has taken before you and will take again, to have comfort in that. It's okay. That's what's going on.
Yeah, it's a challenge too, because you those costs, big chunks, aren't they? They're an overhead that you slot in and now you've got an extra $100,000 in payroll cost.
Yeah, you're like, that's how much I paid myself last year. Like, wait a minute.
I know. It's like flipping heck. And they're not even as good as I am at doing that job yet. And so it does mess with your head. And also what we find is, well, they're not generating any revenue. You know, they're not profit center because they're not actually getting more jobs done. But the thing is, they're required for you to actually go to that next level. You're buying your time back. You're basically creating a bigger factory. Your business is becoming a bigger factory with more capacity to do more work in the long term. And so, like you said, I love that the dip point. That's a great way of putting it. Is you do dip down and then you come up and you'll get to a point where you're super profitable again before you need to invest in the next one and you'll dip down again. That process goes on forever. That's called growing a business.
It's just good to know that those are times that are going to happen. We're going through one right now. We're at another level of organization. You're doing the same. I know you are. And we're working on another level of our organization where it's like, hey, guess what? It's time to invest. Welcome to being an entrepreneur, buddy. Let's go.
That's it. And I think it's super helpful to know that that's normal. It's 100% normal and you should look out for it and you should be excited about it. And just think about it in these terms. You're going to get a lot more investing $100,000 in your business than you will in the bank or any other asset class. Even Bitcoin, because at least you can control it, which is a good thing. One thing I'd love to talk about, Danny, is how the successful business owners that you see treat their employees, because I think this is a big part of it. So what do you see that they do differently?
This is an interesting way of looking at business. And I actually don't even know that this is rules. This is more just what I've noticed. As an owner, you can look at your employees and say, the employee's job is to serve the company. Or you can look at your employees and say, my job is to serve my employees. And I actually think both are true. But I think you as an owner have to take the first step. Because if the employee's job is to serve the company and the customer and always do what's best. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yep.
You as an owner have to go first and say, I'm always going to do what's best for you then. And if your expectation is just that they need to do what's best for the company and what's best for the customer without you going first and saying, actually, they won't. You know, it's the gift of reciprocity. And so as an owner, to know that like all I'm going to do is take care of my people is the first step that I think a lot of people need to feel like, okay, then yeah, I can always take care of you and the company. I will say some people don't think that way and they're shitty people and you might want to fire them. But like, I've always just been one to be like, look, I'm the owner, I'm the leader, like there's lead here. And like, yeah, like I care about you. I care about your success. I care about where you're going in life and I will do everything I can to make you successful. And I'll find good people who feel organically like good. Since you're like, Danny's all about that. Like, I feel like I should be caring about our customer like I never have before, caring about our work and our jobs because he's building into me.
Yeah. We've found the best way to show that you care is to actually care as well. Yeah. As an owner, it's a revolutionary concept, right? There are unfortunately a bunch of owners who, if they really look in the mirror, they look at their staff as just a means of production. Yeah. They're just a means of production. And that's very dehumanizing. And I'm not saying that your team shouldn't do the job and you shouldn't hold them accountable. You should. And winners love that. That's part of the thing, but it is actually fundamentally caring for them as people and providing a great environment. This is the absolute key to success. And that's how you hire and find great people as well. So that culture piece, all that sort of stuff for me is just massive. And the more effort you put into that, it just pays off in spades over and over again down the track.
There was a really good podcast I did with somebody who wrote a book on recruiting, training, and developing people and building a culture properly. And there's the one thing he said, and I've been saying it a lot lately because it keeps coming to my mind, is he's like, Danny, there is 40% of people's effort that is discretionary that they may not ever show you or give. And it's good culture that unlocks that. It's when they feel they're a part of something that's bigger than them. It's when they're stoked, right? And you can think about it too. Like there's people on your team right now that probably do 80% of the work. And it's 20% of your actual team that does most of the work. It's because they're bought in. They're mentally engaged. And the rest of the people are just there for a paycheck. And so, yeah, you know what? Go ahead. You can run a business where it's just like, I just treat you like a means to an end to get a job done. They'll do the same for you. And that'll be the extent of your productivity from your people. But if you want to unlock that other 40%, you do have to genuinely care. But like by doing that, the right people, I won't say everybody, but the right people will give you that 40% discretionary effort all day long.
Yeah. And this the little trick that we've found super helpful here is this feels a bit woolly and a bit woo-woo and quite, what's the word? I don't know. We have a phrase here down under called airy fairy. But it's not if you measure it. And so one thing that's very powerful here is if you actually measure where your team are at, and there's a couple of ways you can do that. One is called ENPS, which is like Employee Net Promoter Score. Basically, you just ask your team, how likely are you to refer a friend or associate to work here on a scale of 1 to 10? And you're looking for 9s or 10s. Which is cool. And then you can also do a bit more of an in-depth sort of survey, maybe every quarter, and really dig down to how people feel about working in your business. And if you measure that and you've got the right intention, you'll see where you're just not quite hitting the mark and you can tweak that. And it's incredibly powerful. Not only do the staff really appreciate it because they know that you care, that you show you that you care by actually, you know, asking their opinion, but it just allows you to make the little tweaks. And yeah, just in our business, I found that our senior leadership team didn't feel like they were getting a positive praise or reinforcement. I'm like, ouch, that's a big lesson for me. Like I am focusing on what needs to be fixed all the time and not actually talking about all the wins. And so I've made a conscious effort to actually go out of my way to find all the wins, which there are heaps, if I just keep my eyes open. And then we survey that again the next time. And funnily enough, it's a better environment for everyone.
That's really good, Tony. You know what I've even noticed for our company? Like the bigger we get, the less aware I am of the business, you know, the day-to-day. And yet I think our team, they're like, well, he must know. How could he not? And so by not having a feedback loop, you create animosity, you create much larger issues because it's not even that you don't care. It's that you probably would if you didn't know, but you didn't set up a way to know and everyone else assumes you do. So it comes off pretty cold. And it's not that you didn't care. It's that you didn't have a mechanism to listen. So that's a really good point. Yeah,
it's a massive one. So let's talk marketing as well, because this is a big part of the puzzle. So why is marketing so important for growth? I mean, it kind of sounds obvious, but I think it's lost on a lot of people.
I mean, I just had another great marketer in my podcast house here earlier today. You know well. We were talking about this. I mean, so it's two things. I mean, one, the obvious reason is you need to be able to have, you know, good leads to be able to have jobs and da da da. But I think that like as a company, you need to be able to choose who your customer actually is. Because if you can't choose, you can't systemize anything because every job is going to be unique and every service is going to be its own thing. And you're going to feel pulled doing too many different types of projects from too many different types of customers. And you can't build a brand around it. And you can't scale anything that's not repeatable. And so I think if you have good marketing, you can start to pick your projects, pick your niche, pick what you're the best at, and then niche into that and then market your niche and then get even more traction because now you're the best in your entire area at that one thing that you do. But until you do that, you'll always be subject to those who call you and you're desperate for work because you got to pay the bills and you're always reactionary doing a bit of randomness, which is not very systemized. It's not very repeatable. It's not very hireable and you're stuck filling all the holes. So I think marketing is kind of the lifeblood of the entire organization for, yes, the reason that you get leads to book jobs to fill the pipeline. But I think even more importantly, to be able to pick your projects, pick your niche, pick your ideal client.
Man, that's so insightful. I mean, it's about power. You know, if you just take whatever you get, like you said, production's a nightmare, but also margins will be a nightmare. And getting paid will be a nightmare because you'll have a bunch of clients who are just frustrating and like to basically string you along. And so if you have that ability to choose who you work with, to a large extent, I mean, it's not always going to be perfect, but to a large extent, if you've got choice around that, then you can, as we say, free up the future of those clients who we can send down the road to destroy the profitability of our least favorite competitor, which is always a good business strategy. For you thinking about marketing, what are the high performing contractors and tradies doing differently with their marketing once they understand that it's important?
I think one, they're focused on having a brand, right? Yep. So as much as it sometimes doesn't feel like that's generating an ROI to the business, they're very focused on being a trusted brand in their area. And I think that it's a combination of their brand and like their brand presence, but also the personality behind the brand. Like, it's edgy, it's cool, it's different, it's them, right? I had a really interesting podcast with one of the founders of Trainual, and they've got really neat marketing. And I was just listening to him talk, and I was like, you're so right. Like, it's having fun with your marketing in ways that are unique to you and not just trying to do what gets leads. It's willing to take some risks and have some, yeah, just like be a little bit unique and wild and crazy if that's who you are or whatever it is you believe in, and making sure that A, you have a brand, but that the brand really speaks to who you are as an owner, so that you resonate with it. Hopefully the people you've hired who resonate with you resonate with it, and your customers, the ideal customers, resonate with that. So I think that's a big piece to it. And then I think the other thing is just understanding the levers that create an ROI in the company. So what is your client acquisition cost? Right? What does it cost you to get a lead? What does it cost you to sell that lead? And now what is your average ticket item for those leads? What's the equation on that? And understanding the math behind this and then building a pipeline around that. So I need to be able to turn this up more, turn this down a little bit to be able to equate a certain amount of paid, a certain amount of referrals, a certain amount of, you know, on-site marketing, and understanding client acquisition cost and lifetime value of your customer by source allows you to actually start to dictate where you need to allocate more time, money, effort, and resources. But if it's just always a spray and pray approach, chances are you're going to waste a lot of money a lot of times. And like, marketing will change every year. What works will change. And so if you monitor it, you have benchmarks, you can change with it and adapt to it. But if you don't see the math behind it, you're going to get ruled over.
I've had a lot of our members ask, oh, what should my marketing budget be? And it's a flawed question because of the things you've talked about. It really is, if I know that it costs me $160 or $200, let's say, to get a job through Google Ads, and that job on average is going to make me $1,200, then I'm like, well, I don't need a budget. I just need to spend more money on marketing and hire more people to do the jobs because it's like you put money in and you get money out. And so if you understand that equation, you're not so worried about the budget. You're just worried about your ability to spend the money in and actually provide the service, which is
ROI,
which
multiple.
Is key. Yeah, the ROI multiple. So I think that's killer. You know, measuring is massive. So one thing, mate, I want to talk about is systems. And before we wind up, now I know you guys, you know, you produce lots of content to educate the market. So do we. This YouTube and the podcast we do, and even the ads and stuff. So what we find, I don't know if you find this, but stuff to do with systems and processes is always super interesting and always hits hard with the listeners. Why do you think that is?
Because I think if you don't have a system, you are the system. I think that you have a choice. You're either a tradesman or you're a businessman. And the difference between the two is someone who builds and operates within a system and someone who does the work. And that's totally fine. And I think for, 100 years, we had a lot of tradesmen in the industry. And I think over the last 15-ish years, a lot of business people have entered the equation. And so the only difference between the two is those who have a system and those who don't. And so you have to ask yourself, like, am I building an asset or am I just sleeping here? Am I renting or am I buying, right? Mm-hmm. Am I renovating or am I just like patching holes? And that is the difference between having a system and not. And so, I don't know, like a lot of us, we're entrepreneurs. We actually identify as an entrepreneur over just a tradesperson. So if that's you, you have to realize like, hey, this is going to be your biggest asset you'll ever own in your entire life. This is going to be the thing that you spend more time on than probably spend with your family. This is going to be the thing that's going to retire you or not, or provide a good financial future or not. And you can pursue a lot of this by being a tradesman. And I don't think there's actually anything wrong with it. Just know that you better love the work, right? And if you love the work and it pays the bills and you're happy, honestly, there's no ego to this. Actually, it's totally cool. But if you're like, hey, I'm trying to scale up a business and I want to be the biggest and baddest and I've got these big dreams, but I'm not building a system, or I don't know how to build a system, or I refuse to because I'm too busy or whatever it is, just know that you're setting yourself up for a bit of a joke, and you have a dream with no implementation of reality. And so choose. Do you want to be a tradesperson? Because you can make good money doing it. You might as well actually honestly probably work for someone or subcontract, and you can make great money. Or do you want to run a business? And if you do, you need a system. Otherwise, you're missing like the vehicle that's going to take you there.
Yeah, it's like the chassis that provides the organization for the business. And I think, you know, people who are listening intuitively know that a system will make life easier, and that a system will make their business operate a bit more like McDonald's than just a man in a van running around trying to organize everything and juggle all the balls. And so if it's written down and it's out of your head, it's a system. Someone else can do it. And I think the thing that you touched on there, which is powerful, is that this actually creates enterprise value. It means that the business, rather than being you, is actually becoming a separate entity to you. And when it's a separate entity to you, that's where it can become a commercial profitable enterprise, which is kind of where we started the discussion around what is actually a successful business. So it's massively important. Now, to get to those systems, and I think we have touched on this a bit, but I want to make sure that we get all of this because I think this is important. How do the actual successful business owners think differently?
They prioritize the long term over the short term. And so they'll make tough calls short term, which cost them more work. They have to fire that key person. They have to invest in that $100,000 salary. They have to take on that new initiative and learn, even though they're done learning. They don't want to learn anymore. Whatever it is, there's an objection where short term, it's going to kind of suck, actually. It's actually the thing that everyone's like, why are we doing this right now? Because they're prioritizing the long term. And it's that old adage, right? Short term pain for long term gain. And I find that over and over and over again. And honestly, as much as I even say this, I've seen it probably the best within my business partner, Igor, who is always working on the future of our organization and always even calls me out sometimes, say like, dude, why are we not doing this? Because it's going to be tough to make that transition happen, or it's going to be tough to take on that new initiative. Or he's like, I know, but like, that's where we're going, isn't it? It's like, yeah. It's like, then we're either building success into our future or we're not. We have to choose. One thing I will say about this actually that motivated me a lot through my younger years. I always thought about like, this was beyond business. This was like me being 18 years old and I was working super hard at school just to get straight A's. And I was trying to get scholarships to go to university. And all my friends were just like hanging out on the weekends and just like partying basically. And they're like, dude, like, why don't you come and hang out with us? I'm like, because there's a future Danny who's 35 years old that is going to thank me. And I want to work hard for future Danny. I want to make sure that guy has a good life because that's where I'm going. Past Danny, it's already over. And so I'm now 38 and I look back at like my 18-year-old self saying that. And I'm like, thank you, 18-year-old Danny. Like, good job. Like, look at all that hard work you put in so that this Danny can actually have a great life with his kids and his home and his business and his stuff. But it was like, it was always being like that and always building and investing into my future because I knew that's where I was going. I wasn't going into my past. I was heading towards the future. So I might as well make a good, comfy, awesome place for there and not borrow from my future like a lot of us do in society. We're used to. We've actually been trained, and the Western world's been trained to borrow from the future. That's what we always do. That's what we're doing all the time. We take out a credit card. We take out a loan. Some of it we can leverage, but generally debt is borrowing from your future. Whereas I was always like, no, let's invest in my future because that's where I'm going.
Yeah, I love Jim Rohn. I know you will have heard of him. He's an absolute weapon. He's dead just now, unfortunately, but he said there's two pains in life, the pain of discipline and the pain of regret, and one weighs in ounces and one weighs in tons. Right. So, you know, discipline is hard, but regret in the long term is way harder. And that's kind of what happens if you don't prioritize your future. You will regret it. You'll be frustrated. And then you'll probably blame other people for your lack of success down the track. But it'll be your own fault. Said with love. And I think there's a couple of other things that really jump out at me is the successful people, they know their worth and they're comfortable with money. They're comfortable with asking for money and they understand the importance of profit. So they have a good sense of who they are and the fact that what they do is valuable, which means they charge appropriately and they make profit. They make profit a habit because a profit doesn't just happen. And the second thing that really stands out at me is they've made that switch to understand that their job is to build the team and the team's job is to grow the business. And that's very powerful. And there's a lot to that. It sounds easy, but there's a lot to it, but it is absolutely critical.
Can I say something about just knowing your value or your worth? You know, the best way to crush any limiting belief you have about your value or your worth? Go up to the top of the tallest building in your city and go look at all the buildings that are surrounding you and think about how much money has gone into building these buildings, how much money has gone into maintaining these buildings, who owns these buildings, how much rent and recurring revenue is. It's billions, if not trillions of dollars in your eyes, just looking over the cityscape. And you're telling me you're not worth 80, 100, 200 bucks an hour? You have no idea how much money and capital exists around you in your city, let alone the rest of the world. And we often limit ourselves because we are used to making 50, 60 bucks an hour as a tradesman. And then we want to kind of like, it's like, just so you know, guys, we're playing a pretty small game no matter how much we charge. There is a ton of wealth around us. And we just need to, as entrepreneurs, understand how to go out there and access it and have the confidence to ask for it.
That is so true. The money is there for those people who know that they deserve it 100%. Man, is there anything else that we haven't covered off that we really should?
I wrote one note on just the transition curve, which we did cover it a little bit, but it's, you know how I said earlier, like the number one trait of an entrepreneur I found early on, like startup mode, was the ability to handle stress in pursuit of a goal. This was actually something that not only did I interview for franchisees, but I also trained and also just myself, like take myself through it all the time. But it's just a good thing to be aware of, which is like when I'm going through good and bad times to identify where I am on the emotional transition curve of entrepreneurship. And so I'll just play this like scenario out for everyone listening and just identify where you are. Hence, everyone's at different places, but it's good to know where. So I think with any new idea, with anything, new job, new employee, new project that you've never done before, whatever, new marketing initiative, there's this thing called, everyone starts at the high, called the uninformed optimism stage. You're like, this is gonna be amazing. What could possibly go wrong? We're gonna hire this guy. He's gonna be a project manager. He's gonna take over all my work. It's gonna be great. Just know that right after that happens, there's another thing that comes right afterwards, which is informed pessimism. This guy sucks. He's costing me a lot of money. I'm spending more time just teaching him how to do his job than I could just do it myself, whatever it is. And that'll continue for a while. And especially that negative language, it's either external or internal. So you're either internalizing, which is, I suck, I'm not a good enough leader, I shouldn't have hired this guy, you're beating yourself up. Or there's external language, which is like, millennials suck, whatever, Gen Z sucks, these like people are lazy, people are stupid, lazy, and unmotivated. But in doing that, you're dragging yourself further down this transition curve until you get to the bottom, which is what's called crisis of meaning, which is like, hey, this guy just blew up a pretty big job, cost me $100,000. I don't know if I can pay payroll next week or whatever as a result of this. And you know that you're in crisis of meaning when you're driving from job site to job site or in the office all day, and you don't really remember how you got to that project or what you did all day. And the only thing that's ringing in your brain is, I don't know why the fuck I'm doing what I'm doing. And literally, you're probably swearing in your own brain. And it's important when you're there to acknowledge and realize and understand that this is just a stage. This is not you. This is not who you will always be. And a lot of people at this stage give up right when it was time to like figure something out. Like they had an opportunity to grow from it. And so the thing I often do, I sit back and I'm like, okay, why am I doing what I'm doing? I pray. I talk to my wife. I talk to my friends. I actually take space. I make zero decisions. So what we were talking about earlier, like high emotion, low intelligence, making zero decisions. I'm usually not like in meetings, like I'll cancel a meeting or two because I need to just have space to breathe and find my why again and rest. And from there, I need to just realize like, it's not whether I can or cannot do something. It's my ability to ask, how can I? And slowly start to problem solve the circumstance and not to fix the problem or not fix the problem, but to be in the process of figuring it out with no exact end date. I won't fully know like when it actually gets resolved, but I know that over time, I'm in the process of figuring this out. And over time, as most of you have probably been through this before, it's like these transition curves happen on big annual cycles and sometimes small, even micro weekly cycles, but we all go through them. But over time, the solution becomes clear. And the thing gets worked out. And guess what? You moved on and you learned something from it. And now you're in what's called informed realism, which is you now know that it sucks and that it's hard, but you've solved it once. And the next time you go through it, the transition curve up and down is lower, is less. What we were talking about earlier about like being in business for so long, having a bit more of an ability to take on more risk and more like complexity, it's because you go through those transition curves and come out on the other side into informed pessimism or informed realism. But if you as an entrepreneur reach these transition curves and you get to the very bottom and you give up on that employee or you give up on that strategy or you give up on that, like chances are you're going to form a limiting belief. And for the rest of your business career, you're going to always tell your staff, whether it's subtly, subconsciously, or actually say to them, that can't be done. And then your team, your customers, yourself, everyone around you will just start to repeat that back to you. And you'll just become a believer that that can't be done. And so just know that as you go after all this stuff that me and Tony are talking about, and you go for growth and you put yourself in a scenario you've never been before, you're going to go through transition. That's totally normal. We are too, just so you know. And being aware of that emotional transition curve is probably the most important thing, because you can see, hey, I'm here right now. Okay, what do I need to do next? Versus nobody ever goes through this. I got to get out. It's like, no. Just so you know, welcome to being an entrepreneur. It's a part of
the process. And what happens is you build your entrepreneurial muscle, which is actually dealing with the uncertainty, the fear, the frustration. If you do it once, your muscles are a bit stronger. You can do it again. If you keep doing it, eventually you get to the point where those entrepreneurial muscles are very strong. If you don't do it, they get weaker. Your confidence goes down and you end up basically dying in a hole in your business, which is not where you want to be. That was exceptionally helpful. That curve is, that awareness of that is very powerful. because it is a mental game, and getting on top of the mental game actually helps you implement all this, the strategies and tactics that actually make the difference. Man, this has been super fun. I think there's some absolute gold here. I've certainly learned some stuff as well, man, and I appreciate, you know, being able to spend some time with you, Danny, talking about the stuff that we're both so passionate about. And my hope is that if you've been listening today, that you've got some gold nuggets you can take away, actually put into action in your business and get some meaningful results so that your business, more importantly, that your life is more successful, more peaceful, and more happy. This has been fun, man. Appreciate you.
Every time I'm talking to you, I'm chuckling to myself, realizing that, you know, all the things we teach a lot of these contractors, you and I as business owners of these training companies also have so much in common. And I really appreciate getting to know you. And I also sense and feel a lot of what the people we coach feel, just having this community of like-minded entrepreneurs around us. I love talking.
So. Yeah, it's good stuff, man. Take good care, buddy.
Okay. Thanks, Tony.
Next week on the Profitable Tradie Podcast.
Today is the 200th episode of the Profitable Tradie Podcast, and there's lots of things we could talk about and celebrate. But in the end, we've decided that there's one thing that has stood out putting together the previous 199 episodes. Now, one thing that is holding back most business owners, and one thing that will make a huge difference to you and your business. Now, tune into this episode if you want the hard truth about what's stopping you from getting the business that you want.
Congratulations on being part of a select group of savvy business owners who are taking their businesses to the next level. And to help you on your journey, don't forget to check out our show notes for a copy of our free book, The Profitable Tradie, and other valuable resources. Thanks for being a part of this special group, and we'll see you in the next episode of the Profitable Tradie Podcast.